You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's been 2 years since Wisconsin signed on to the multi-billion dollar Foxconn deal. We'll find out how the agreement has shifted and changed over time and what it could mean for the economic future of the state. Now, the United States is facing the prospect of constitutional failure. That's according to a USA Today piece by our next guest, who says President Trump is exposing flaws in the U.S. Constitution, and that could make one of the founders' worst fears come true with the rise of an authoritarian leader. Chris Edelson is an assistant professor of government at American University's School of Public Affairs. His most recent book is Power Without Constraint, The Post-9/11 Presidency and National Security. Chris, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, one of the starting points of your concern is your argument that President Trump is a would-be authoritarian. Not everyone listening will agree with that idea. Make the case.
Yes, and it's a word that's rather loaded. I don't mean he's Hitler or Mussolini. He's not. An authoritarian is simply a leader who doesn't support constitutional democracy, who thinks the rules don't apply to him or her, who thinks they're above the law, who doesn't believe in individual rights, protections for minorities. Constitutional democracy protects all of those things. Donald Trump doesn't support them.
And you compare him in the piece to more like what we're seeing these days in Russia, Hungary, and Turkey.
Yes, those are better comparisons than Hitler, although he's not a Putin either. But what's clear is that Donald Trump, he said this. He just said the other day, he said Article 2 of the Constitution lets me do whatever I want. That's not true, but he thinks it's true, and he's working really hard to make it true.
You use the phrase constitutional failure. Some people have talked about constitutional crisis lately. What do you mean by constitutional failure in the modern day?
Yes, you're right. People talk about constitutional crisis, which I think is a vague and imprecise term. It's not clear what it means. Constitutional failure simply means the system isn't working. Madison and the framers designed a system of checks and balances. It was supposed to protect against any one branch of government getting too much power. That's the theory, but it's not working. We have a president who's made his authoritarian tendencies clear. He would like to govern without restraint on his power. He said that very plainly. In theory, under our system, that should mean that he would be checked by other branches of government, most prominently Congress. But we've gotten used to the idea, and I think it's a dangerous to get used to this, that no matter what outrage we will see from Donald Trump, whether it's calling on non-white members of Congress to go home to their countries, even though they're Americans, defaming an American city, challenging the independence of the Federal Reserve, offering to accept assistance from foreign countries, Republicans in Congress simply will not act. That's constitutional failure.
What would you like to see from Congress in this situation?
Well, really, in my view, when there's a president who doesn't support constitutional democracy, that president should be removed from office. An authoritarian, a would-be authoritarian, is an existential threat to the system. They don't believe in constitutional democracy. Donald Trump doesn't believe in. He has said very plainly, he has said he would like to rule for life. He would like to have a third term. He's not joking about that. He really wants it. He really thinks he can rule without constraint on power. So a system that can't defend itself against that kind of threat is a failed system. At the very least, Republicans in Congress should be doing something tangible, holding hearings, making clear that there are consequences for what Donald Trump has done. They're essentially doing nothing. So I think that's a real failure.
Talking to Chris Edelson from American University about a piece he wrote saying America under the Trump presidency is facing constitutional failure. Chris, does that mean this is an issue that, as you were just saying, Republicans in Congress have the problem? Or is this a systemic problem and maybe needs systemic changes?
It's a systemic problem. It's not a partisan issue. This doesn't have to do with whether you're conservative or liberal. It has to do with whether you think there should be effective limits on power. The same exact problem could come up with a Democratic president who had authoritarian tendencies. We haven't seen that recently, but it could happen. And Republicans aren't the only ones failing. I mean, you see Democrats hesitating every day to begin impeachment inquiries. That's a failure as well. So it is a systemic failure. It's not unique to Donald Trump, and there have been warning signs for a while. It's something that needs to be fixed if you believe in constitutional democracy.
Let's step back. You mentioned that this has been in the works maybe for a while. You've written in the past, including in a book, about the presidency gaining more and more power in realms like national security. Have we been slowly ceding? Has Congress been ceding too much power to the executive branch, to the president?
Yes, great point. And thanks for adding that context. I wrote a book in 2016 criticizing the Obama presidency because President Obama was taking actions, especially in the context of the use of military force, that were unconstitutional. Obama was not an authoritarian. Neither was George W. Bush, for that matter. But both Bush and Obama did use presidential power in ways that violated the Constitution, and there was no meaningful response. The reason I wrote my book in 2016 was to sound a warning. Basically, what I was arguing was, if you can't put limits on presidential power, you're basically trusting the president to self-regulate. That might work to an extent with an Obama or a Bush because they did believe in constitutional democracy. We're seeing what happens when you have someone who doesn't.
What kind of structural change would you like to see? What do we need to do to safeguard American democracy from the risk of a president with too much power willing to use that power inappropriately?
Great question. I'll try to answer briefly. Obviously, it's complicated, but basically the first thing I think is, if you were starting today, would you choose this system? I think very few people would. The Electoral College doesn't make sense anymore. It's not even used in the way it was intended, which was a profoundly anti-democratic goal. The Senate doesn't make sense. We have very small population states with the same representation as large population states. We need an independent Justice Department. We've seen that very clearly recently with Attorney General Barr, who's acting as sort of a personal lawyer for the president. We need to get money out of elections. That gives more power to the wealthy, and it makes it easier for someone to gain power without majority support. So we basically need to make the system both more democratic. Authoritarians usually don't have majority support, or would be authoritarians. Trump doesn't. So no system can guarantee that it will be guarded against authoritarians, but let's make it harder. Let's make the system more democratic, but also set effective limits. Another limit I would advocate for would be something more effective than the clearly useless impeachment process, which won't work. We need something that can actually be used when you have a president in office who is corrupt or dangerous or not fit for office.
Let's talk about that last point before we dig into some of those more fundamental changes. What would you see as a better version or replacement for impeachment as it exists?
I'm not sure. That's a hard question. I think it's clear that the present system simply doesn't work. You're not going to – I mean, you could make arguments. Bill Clinton was a very different president than Donald Trump. Clinton was not an authoritarian, but there were serious abuses of office. He was impeached, but there was no way he was going to be removed from office because – the system doesn't work that way anymore. Madison envisioned that members of Congress would have an allegiance to their branch of government. If a president went too far, they, as members of Congress, would be offended by the president taking their power away. Now members of Congress see themselves as partisans first, whether it's a Democrat supporting Bill Clinton or Republicans supporting Donald Trump. So we need something different. I'm not sure exactly what it would be. I think it's worth thinking about, you know, something more like in a parliamentary system where there's no confidence vote, maybe something where there would be some provision to call for a new election along those lines. I'm not sure exactly. What is clear to me, though, is the present system, impeachment is a paper tiger. It's not really usable.
Yeah, you wrote about James Madison, I think it was, saying, hey, we're not going to count on people to be angels here. We're going to count on the selfish ambition of members of Congress and protecting their own powers, their selfish ambition to do that and not give them up to the president as a safeguard. How do we get back to that? How do we get loyalty to the institution of Congress for the people who serve in it?
I'm not sure if we can. I mean, when you read the Federalist Papers, it sounds really great because Madison sounds really realistic. He says, hey, we know people aren't great. We're not going to trust any one person with power. But what we're going to do is use human instinct to our advantage. Everyone wants power. So we'll have each branch jealously guard its own power. That doesn't account for partisanship, and I don't think we can take that out of the system. Partisanship, by the way, is not always a bad thing either. We do have a democratic system. It's not an absolute democracy, but there should be times when partisanship matters. There just have to be limits. And so I think we have to think about it in a different way. I don't think we can count on members of Congress to transcend their partisan allegiances. We need different mechanisms, maybe some kind of commission that exists outside of Congress. You know, maybe more power within the executive branch. Like I mentioned before, the Department of Justice, which right now is supposed to be independent as a norm, as an informal rule, but there's nothing that prevents the president from taking it over. Maybe the Department of Justice could be made formally independent of the executive branch. So I think it's coming up with not just counting on Congress to set limits, but empowering other people, other parts of the government to set limits. Of course, we do have the courts as well, and the courts have been effective to some extent, but I think it's a lot to count on them alone. They need help.
We're talking to American University's Chris Edelson. He wrote the recent opinion piece in the USA Today titled, "Donald Trump and Congress Are Showing Us What Constitutional Failure Looks Like." You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about our guest's argument, the ideas he's put out there? Do you see President Trump as a would-be authoritarian leader? What do you want to see from Congress when it comes to oversight of this or any other presidency? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Chris Edelson, Assistant Professor of Government at American University's School of Public Affairs, about what he sees as a constitutional failure in the U.S. Being highlighted by President Trump and the current Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry that the United States could slip into an authoritarian system? Too much power being given to the executive branch, not enough oversight being given by Congress, under President Trump in particular, over time in general? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Chris, you were talking about things like changing the electoral college system, the representation in the Senate, an independent Department of Justice. But if our system can't fix the problems we're facing now anyway, how is it going to tackle making big changes like that?
You're right. And I was going to say that next. These things are not plausible right now. That doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about them, but there will have to be work done before this can happen. In 1787, the United States had a system in place that was failing, like ours is today, that was the Articles of Confederation. The framers of the Constitution met in Philadelphia to try to come up with a replacement. They understood it might not work. It came very close to failing because they needed to get it passed in enough states, and it was very narrowly passed in some big states. It was a near miss. They got it done. My point in raising that example is that just because something seems implausible doesn't mean it shouldn't be tried, but there, of course, will have to be work done. I think starting with the public, Madison said in the Federalist Papers that the people are the primary check in government power. People have tools available then to take action if they want these changes to occur. It won't happen overnight by any means, but if we want it, there are things we can do to start working on this.
Is the partisan divide, though, among the people as bad as the partisan divide among members of Congress? Will the people be able to agree any better than Congress would?
Maybe. I mean, we have to see. I'm trying to want to be an optimist about this, because when I talk about this, a lot of times people say it sounds really depressing. I don't mean for it to be depressing. I'm trying to describe what I see as the reality and then think about how to change it. So you're right. I mean, these points are good ones. It's not going to be easy. The country is divided, both in Congress and in the nation as a whole. What is clear to me, though, as a starting point, is a lot of people are deeply frustrated with what's going on right now and with the Trump presidency. This is a deeply unpopular president. Polling shows that he is typically around 41-42% for popularity. Even on Election Day 2016, he didn't have a majority. So a lot of people recognize, and not just – this isn't a partisan issue. Lots of Republicans understand just how bizarre this is. Conservatives like David Frum from the Bush White House, Bill Kristol, Dan Quayle's former chief of staff. So I think there are people who understand this is not a partisan issue. We'll have to see if there's enough of them to make a difference.
Given popular frustration maybe with Congress, with American politics in general, do you worry that the public will say – well, maybe representative government isn't all it's cracked up to be. Maybe there will be sympathy for the idea of more power vested in one leader.
There is sympathy, obviously, already. And that is – it's worrying. It's dangerous. The support for Donald Trump shows that there are a lot of people who are happy with this. There's nothing – this is something I think is important to say. There's nothing that guarantees constitutional democracy if we care about it, if we care about a system where there are free and fair elections, where officials in government are accountable, where the rule of law applies, where minority rights are protected, where people can't be punished for what they say or whether if they criticize the government. We're going to have to stand up for it. And you're right. It's not a given. There are lots of people. I don't think it's a majority. I don't think there's any evidence it's a majority, but it's a substantial minority who I think are not comfortable with or maybe don't even support constitutional democracy.
Talking to Chris Edelson from American University about a piece in the USA Today about constitutional failure in the United States in the Trump presidency with the current Congress. Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. Paul is with us in Columbus. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Paul?
I just want to make a comment about the electoral college. I mean, there's 9 million people in the county of L.A., let alone in one county. There's more people in the county of L.A. than there is in Rhode Island. I just, you know, I don't know what the other option is than electoral college, but I don't think it's a good thing for New York and California to pick our president.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. And Chris, Paul bringing up the same concerns that gave us the Electoral College and the Senate, fears that states like Virginia and New York, I guess, would dominate smaller states if you didn't disperse that power somehow.
I mean, I don't think that would be a good thing. It's not what's happening right now. New York and California are irrelevant. So is Texas, because we know which way they're going to vote. The states that matter are a few battleground states. Your state, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, a handful of others. So the Electoral College was set up with the idea that people would choose electors to make the decision for them. It was a profoundly anti-democratic idea. The framers of the Constitution didn't trust people. They didn't want a king, but they also didn't trust people to make decisions completely by themselves. So the system doesn't work that way anymore. I don't think it was a good idea to start with. But the way it works now is a few battleground states make the decision. I think if we were starting from scratch today, I don't think anyone would want that. I guess maybe people in the battleground states. You might know better than me being one yourself. But there's nothing that strikes me as principled in having a system like that.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Joan in Eau Claire. Joan, hi.
Good afternoon. I think that Donald Trump would have absolutely no problem with being even more of a dictator than he is. I'm very disappointed with the fact that people are, the Republicans, that is, are letting him get away with all these little things that he does that chip away at the sanctity and the structure of our democracy. I mean, our institutions, just every little bit changes things. And when a Republican who is a senator panders to him, that diminishes their position. It diminishes the position of the presidency. It's very anxiety-ridden for me, but I think that he would have no problem with, if the laws allowed it, being a complete dictator. And the Republicans are really not standing up for the citizens that they represent. They're really just pandering to him.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. I could see that hypothetical Republican Senator Chris saying to Joan and maybe to you, well, we think the issue is you just disagree with our policy issues. You're crying wolf over creeping authoritarianism. Give it time. You'll elect a different president. Things might swing back your way.
So what I'd say in response to that, there's a really good book called How Democracies Die. It's written by two professors at Harvard, and they lay out a test for – they've studied authoritarian regimes in Latin America and Europe. And they say they've seen common themes. Would-be authoritarians do the same kind of things. They call their opponents enemies who are illegitimate. They condone the use of violence. They don't reject the idea of political violence. They try to put loyalists in positions in the government, like we're seeing right now with Donald Trump trying to name a congressman to be the director of national intelligence. They try to change the rules to benefit them, like Trump is trying to do with the census. And what's important is that in a normal partisan back and forth, Republicans would support Trump, Democrats would support – would be opposing him. That's what would happen if he were an ordinary president. One sign that he's not an ordinary president is so many Republicans and conservatives who are speaking out, the Never Trumpers. I mentioned David Frum and Bill Kristol before. And that's one warning sign that this is something unusual and dangerous is going on. This is not ordinary partisan politics.
Thanks for the call, Joan. We'll go to Sarah now in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, I am very worried that we're headed in an authoritarian direction. I think if he gets a third term, a second term, we're going to see more of it. I'm worried that the Supreme Court is now really in favor of Trump and that they will approve his executive orders, that even if they are contrary to established U.S. law and like this recent ruling approving that he can take money from the military to fund building the wall. I'm worried about how they're going to rule on the challenges to his change of the asylum law, which is contrary to what's stated in the Immigration Act. And so I think that he's basically created, by appointing so many judges, he's just created rubber stamp for his policies.
Sarah, thanks for the call. Chris, the role of the courts here.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that. First of all, the last two callers, I'm glad to hear people like this. People are paying attention. Donald Trump has not succeeded yet. People can speak out. There are lots of tools available to us. I agree with the caller about the Supreme Court. But We've seen very recently in Puerto Rico, mass peaceful protests got the governor to resign. In Hong Kong, which really is an authoritarian regime, it's part of China, which is a dictatorship. It's not a would-be authoritarian regime. It's an actual authoritarian regime. People protested, and they got Hong Kong to drop a law that was going to extradite people to mainland China. They're continuing to protest over violence there. They've been beaten up by thugs. We have tools available to us, and that's something we should be grateful for. So sure, yes, I don't trust – unfortunately, I'm sorry to say this. The Supreme Court seems more loyalist to Trump than an objective body. But there are lots of tools available to us, and we can and should use them. And the important thing is if people recognize that there's something dangerous going on, they can take action. And by the way, I would be happy in my view. This isn't a partisan issue. I would like everyone to be involved, whatever they think. Democracy fails when people don't act, whatever their views are. So people should get involved if they care about this.
Thanks a lot for that call, Chris. In our last minute, what are you watching for? What is the next domino you'd be watching for in the next few months?
Well, what I'm hoping for is some action. I'm hoping that people will recognize there's a problem and take action. For a long time, I would watch Republicans in Congress and I would say what will move them to act. Unfortunately, I don't think there's anything that would do that at this point. So what I look for is, will people take action? And of course, we do have an election coming up, and we'll see what happens with that. Donald Trump remains deeply unpopular. If people get organized and take action, if they think Donald Trump is dangerous, they can vote him out of office. And that would be – that's the big next big major event I'm looking at.
Chris, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And thank you to the callers.
That's Chris Edelson, Assistant Professor of Government at American University's School of Public Affairs. He's the author of Power Without Constraint, The Post-9/11 Presidency and National Security. Been talking about a piece he wrote in the USA Today about the risk of constitutional failure in the United States. Coming up, we'll talk about how Wisconsin's Foxconn deal has changed since an agreement was made 2 years ago. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent's guest says women's voices are often ignored, mocked, or silenced, and she has advice on how to change that. Kate talks to Veronica Rickert, author of the new book Outspoken, tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, it's been 2 years since Governor Scott Walker's administration struck a multi-billion dollar deal with Foxconn to build a factory in the southeastern part of the state. At the time of the agreement, President Trump celebrated its future in Wisconsin.
Congratulations on truly one of the eighth wonder. I think we can say this is, we can say, the eighth wonder of the world. This is the eighth wonder of the world.
According to the agreement, in 2017, Foxconn would spend roughly $10 billion to build an LCD screen factory in Mount Pleasant. It was originally estimated that the plant would create anywhere from 3,000 to 13,000 jobs. In exchange, Wisconsin would provide billions in tax breaks and other incentives. A lot has changed in the 2 years since the agreement between the Walker administration and Foxconn. The plans for the plant changed, the number and types of jobs were revised, and two key players changed with the election of Governor Tony Evers and the departure of Foxconn boss Terry Goh to run for office himself. Art Sear is director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College. Art, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the kind and unexpected invitation.
Well, it's been a roller coaster with Foxconn over the last couple of years. What strikes you about the changes we've seen since this agreement was reached?
Well, as you just indicated, they've obviously cut back quite substantially in terms of their initial commitment. But it's still an unfolding situation, especially in view of their generally negative press, not just in Wisconsin. I think it's important to add that, supplement that by saying that this is still a substantial investment, and over time they probably would not be taking these risks if they did not have a pretty good sense of the payoff. They're obviously big enough to be politically sensitive as well, and they don't want to make the Americans any more angry than necessary.
What stood out to you at the time about the deal as originally signed?
Well, I have no inside information, but I with the comfortable position of being a professor, and also now with 20/20 hindsight, it seemed to me that Governor Walker was indulging his cheerleader side a bit too much. And I do have the chance to observe a lot of successful politicians from the sidelines, and usually they hedge their bets more. And obviously it was a factor in his loss, narrow but clear loss, to Governor Evers.
And the plan was to build LCD screens for television, so larger screens. The company told Reuters it'd be too expensive to build those. They've changed it now to maybe a smaller scale plant or an AI development hub. What are you looking for when it comes to the kinds of jobs? It looked like there might be more manufacturing jobs. Now it looks like it might be more technology kinds of jobs. Still jobs. Doesn't matter what kind of jobs.
Yes, indeed. The total number also matters. Governor Evers, I'm not being partisan, I must say, especially given his predecessor, his low-key approach seems to me to be politically advantageous. He's also been very careful to emphasize rather specific information, and his report to the state and to the electorate and beyond just last month indicated that they estimate it'll be about 1,300 jobs, a good deal less, and a good deal more specialized and technical, as you imply, than the original promise.
Talking to Art Sear from Carthage College about the unfolding saga of Foxconn, its deal with Wisconsin, what might end up happening in the long run. Art, stepping back from Foxconn in particular, do you have thoughts on government incentives being used to lure big projects, whether as big as the Foxconn one or smaller ones? What do you think of the role of things like tax cuts and other incentives to bring the business across the state's lines?
Well, I think it's a part of life, and as usual in the real world, the results are mixed, but there are certainly government supports, especially through tax credits, that have been very helpful to all kinds of industries and all kinds of commerce and investment over time. In the electronics industry, we have some structural disadvantages compared to other lower-cost parts of the world. It's also an increasingly global and ruthlessly competitive business. And I think insofar as we have advantage or can generate advantage through offering carrots to foreign companies, we definitely should do so. And I do believe there are political as well as, to some extent currently, but potentially much, much more significantly economic advantages. But the political dimensions of Foxconn's presence, I think, are too often neglected.
Yeah, talk about those a little more, if you would.
Well, Foxconn obviously was politically motivated to come to Wisconsin, as well as the fact that we're a great location for any kind of manufacturing, and for that matter, service distribution center. But they must have been mindful of the fact that Paul Ryan was at the time Speaker of the House, and Rance Priebus was Chief of Staff in the White House. And before that, when this deal was first announced and talked about a couple of years ago, he was Chairman of the Republican National Committee. There are a lot of political, and there are a lot of public relations and also political advantages to being seen as a good guy investing in the heartland of the U.S., especially given Foxconn's pretty negative public image, not just in this country, but generally.
Well, both those figures you just mentioned, Paul Ryan and Rance Priebus, out of their jobs they held at the time, also Governor Scott Walker, no longer governor. Foxconn and its leadership probably want to still cultivate good relations with the American president with this deal. Is there still enough political incentive for them to make sure they deliver on what they've offered in Wisconsin?
Yeah, they certainly don't want to make the president mad. He did put himself at risk, again, with comfortable hindsight, by, in his usual fashion, extolling this new investment and probably exaggerating even the greatest possible benefits, but he put himself at risk, and he also, as part of his very successful political strategy so far in terms of winning the White House, very publicly put pressure on Foxconn to not renege on their deal, and they did at least publicly commit to doing more, and doing more certainly than just research. They are, as I think you indicated, definitely going to go ahead with a smaller LCD screen operation in our part of the country.
Speaking of your part of the country, this is debated at the state level, the national level a lot, but you are, in the scope of things, in the neighborhood of this project, at least in the region of it. Has this been something that's really got people excited in southeastern Wisconsin?
Yes, indeed. Darwin Sen and Eric Johnson and foreign languages and economics, respectively, two fine, very effective younger faculty in teaching, but also outside the classroom. Darwin is from Taiwan and highly entrepreneurial. They put together a three-panel discussion under the general auspices of our Clausen Center early on in the project. And we were overwhelmed at the first session by an enormous, unexpected crowd, quite unusual for a small college like us with that kind of... And I remember clearly, because speaking of advanced technology and telecom, I'd left my cell phone in the car when we had this mob scene. Fortunately, our president, John Swallow, was there, and his assistant, Paul Hegland, were both fully armed. We did have a backup room, thank God, so we were able to move this crowd. And I assure you, you never want to be fooled twice. We were thoroughly prepared for the next two sessions. But it was very good. That kind of problem is a good problem to have. It was a failure on my part, but it was great discussion, great publicity. I was impressed at the diversity of the crowd, especially in terms of age. It wasn't just anxious older people, but a lot of younger people as well, and people who were not unemployed, had not been the victims of eminent domain, had not been in any kind of serious sense disrupted by this, but they were upset about the possibility of having their homes taken over by the state. They were concerned about the disruption they experienced with a tremendous highway expansion and renovation that, as you probably know, began almost immediately after this deal was announced. There's a lot of fear. You know, FDR made a great point when he emphasized fear itself. And that really brought home to me how serious this kind of situation is in the minds of many, many of our fellow citizens.
We're talking to Art Searer right now about the latest with Foxconn and its deal, its project here in Wisconsin. He's director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Foxconn deal 2 years out? What would you like to see happen at the plant since the deal has shifted some since it was originally signed? Do you live in the area? Has your life been affected by the project already? Have you done work somehow related to the development for the project? Do you hope to work for Foxconn, or are you a supplier that's hoping to sell to Foxconn in the future? We'd love to hear from you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about the status of Wisconsin's multi-billion-dollar deal with Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Foxconn. It's been 2 years since that agreement was signed. Art Searer stays with us, director of the A.W. Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the current state of the deal? If you live in Mount Pleasant or the area, how did this impact your community, your life? Do you think the state is making a good decision to make this investment? How do you think Foxconn could change Wisconsin? What is your verdict, pro, con, or still up in the air? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to Katie now in Eau Claire. Katie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Katie?
The innovation centers that are supposed to be popping up in some of the other communities in the state of Wisconsin. What's happening with those?
Katie, thanks for the call. Art, there's been some reporting that the places have been rented in some cases, but otherwise, or bought, but not a lot else going on. But that was part of the package deal here, these innovation centers that are supposed to be around the state, investment in the UW as well.
Yes, indeed. My understanding, and I did have time to do a little research before your very kind phone call this morning over here, the company has bought a lot of real estate, and there are a lot of mostly empty buildings around the state. Again, this is a for-profit enterprise. I dare say it's not an empty gesture. So at some point, they're going to get filled with some things and some people. It's important to keep in mind that while Foxconn is the, I believe, the fourth largest precision electronics corporation in the world after Apple, Amazon, and Samsung, their profit margin is very narrow. They don't have the giant cash resources of other companies. So in a rapidly changing business, it's not surprising that they often make changes rather quickly and particularly ruthlessly. They're a very big company, but one with a very narrow margin for error. And that explains some of their behavior, along with the fact that Terry Gou has a well-deserved reputation for being, if I may say so, particularly cold-blooded in putting survival and then profits above everything else. So in other places, including Brazil, India, and right next door, Pennsylvania, they have drastically reneged on past promises. I don't think that will be the case with Wisconsin.
Part of the hope, Art, was that this wasn't going to just be Foxconn, that this would be the core of a new technology sector here in Wisconsin. Is that wishful thinking, or do you think that's something that could happen?
I think it is happening. There's been a tremendous amount of investment, and it continues worldwide into the Great Lakes region and our immediate region. More than half the interstate truck traffic in North America passes through the Milwaukee-Chicago corridor for very good reasons. Chicago, believe it or not, is one of the largest container ports in the world. Clear, obviously not a seaport, but in terms of the total amount and rapidly growing amount of rail, truck, intermodal, as it's called, and to some extent even air traffic, the transportation and trade activity in this region is growing tremendously. I mentioned Amazon; they've got a big distribution center right off I-94 in Kenosha, near where I work at Carthage College, and many of our listeners are well aware of that because it's as big as the Pentagon. Uline is another company, not high-tech, but rapidly growing, that's in the area, and advanced technology is part of that general migration. The state has also been extremely successful in luring companies large and small from south of the border, given the high taxes and, to some extent, difficult union problems and the challenging political atmosphere, to put it politely, of Chicago and Illinois. The Kenosha Area Business Alliance in Kenosha County has chapter and verse, lots of information readily available on their website concerning this migration. So we're in a good part of the country, and the old-fashioned Rust Belt imagery, quite deserved in the 70s and 80s and even later, has changed. The trouble is that it's a much more rapidly changing environment than it used to be, and the days when you could finish high school or even just the eighth grade and get a lifelong secure job on the line at Chrysler in Kenosha, for instance, just like your dad and maybe your grandfather had, or mother, those days are long gone, and they're not going to come back.
Talking to Art Sear from Carthage College in Kenosha, looking at the Foxconn deal in Wisconsin 2 years in. Let's go back to our callers now. Anna is with us, driving a truck, I believe, in Wisconsin. Anna, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Anna, and I'm a truck driver in the Wisconsin area. There's something, I'm from Taiwan, and I'm from the same place as there, the Foxconn's headquarters. Basically, we're living on the same metro, whatever, the subway line. I'm living in the east end, and the headquarters of Foxconn is in the very west end of the same subway. Anyway, I find it very tricky to have Foxconn's projects going on in Wisconsin, and I believe it's going to bring a negative impact towards the community around. First reason is it's going to bring in lots of foreign workers, and somehow that, I'm sorry to say this, that might sound a little bit racist, but it's going to bring out lots of foreign workers, and they're going to be like super high pay, well educated. they're going to push the local residents to something like cheaper place, like remote place. There's something called the Silicon Valley effect, where local residents no longer be able to afford the housing at where they usually live or used to live, and then those housing costs will be boosted up by those whatever foreign immigrants.
Anna, interesting. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective. Art, Anna is worried that her company from her home country is going to drive up housing costs for people in the area, bringing in high-paid workers from around the world.
I think that's a very good point, and it's as you indicate, it's particularly important to have a perspective from somebody from Taiwan, and also who's driving a truck, ideally timed in terms of our conversation about transportation and shipping in this part of the country. To actually answer the question, the numbers involved are not great enough at this point to impact the housing market significantly statewide. It may do so over time locally. They are bringing in some high-tech types for what will be, unlike their original commitment, very much a research center, and that's generated understandable concern and criticism, mostly political rather than economically motivated. They will have to, if they're going to have a reasonable existence here, they're going to have to hire a lot of local people. One related problem for technically trained workers is Foxconn has been asking people to spend periods of time of up to a year training overseas in Taiwan, which for a working person can be kind of an unexpected blow and make a job considerably less attractive, I would think. In terms of ancillary services for all the highway construction and building construction and related supplies that are definitely being purchased and created and underway, there's already a lot of employment for workers who are not in the high-tech sector. So as usual, it's mixed. But a big sticking point is that they've gotten $130 million, not tax credits, but actual money so far from Racine and Mount Pleasant, and about $120 million has already been committed in actual taxpayer dollars to highway construction and reconfiguration in southeast Wisconsin. And so the state, meaning the taxpayers, is on the hook for a noticeable amount of money. And the payoff will be long-term, I think, at best. Let me mention that Austin Carr, C-A-R-R, of the high-quality Bloomberg News Service, has done great research and writing on this subject. And public radio is to be commended for interviewing him early this year.
Well, to be continued, Art, thanks a lot for taking the time today. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you and your colleagues. It's actually part of my job and what Tom Clawson had in mind when he created not the center. That was our president and trustees, but he and his wife were kind enough to endow the Clawson chair, and he was interested in somebody who could make the college more visible in positive ways, we hope. So this is part of my work, and I want to thank you helping me do my job. Thank you very much.
Thanks. That's Art Sear, director of the A.W. Clawson Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. He joins us today to talk about Foxconn, 2 years since the multi-billion-dollar deal was signed, and what's happening with that agreement today. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, nature could have its day in court, as some environmental law experts say natural resources should have rights defined under national and international law. Find out more and share your thoughts. Online gaming can be a lot of fun. It can bring people together as a community, but it can also be packed with abuse and hostility. We'll find out why two-thirds of online gamers say they've experienced severe harassment and what, if anything, could be done about it. And we'll look back at the history of one of Wisconsin's most devastating tornadoes in Colfax back in 1958. All that, plus a look at some of the top national news of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, some Wisconsin farmers are finding a new revenue stream by creating tourist destinations. Find out how agritourism works and share your own experiences on either side of it tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then you may remember band and choir classes back in school. Our guest says music education needs to change its tune to be more relevant, engaging, and fun for today's students. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.